This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
To judge by Times Square today, Sandy seemed to be more of a myth. But downtown, it's clear the Big Apple took a big hit.
Yeah, look at this whole neighborhood right here.
Oh, man.
The system that carries 5 million riders every day, still a deluged tunnel of darkness.
Block after block, mile after mile of this kind of ruins. And in that wreckage behind me, we can hear the gas lines hissing.
The Jersey Shore of my youth, where we used to go all the time, it is gone.
Those were the sounds from 1 year ago when Superstorm Sandy slammed into the New York region. The epic storm destroyed and reshaped parts of the coastline. It moved sand and cement, homes and habitats. Politicians vowed to rebuild. New York Mayor Bloomberg put out his own proposal for long-term sustainable planning. New Jersey Governor Christie, the last voice in that montage, said his state would rebound. And the federal government, after months of talking, allocated $51 billion for recovery. But what would it really take to build back smarter? Adding back the sand, nourishing the beaches, as it's called, putting buildings up on stilts? Or maybe we shouldn't rebuild all of it and instead retreat in some places from the coastline as rising seas promise to bring back big storm surges. That's what we'll be talking about this hour. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. And if you want more information, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Robert Young is a professor of coastal geology and the director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be with you, Ira.
Thank you. Joseph Vitri is the director of the National Planning Center for Coastal and Storm Damage for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Phil Orton. Philip Orton is a research scientist in physical oceanography at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey, which really got hit hard by Sandy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Joe, let me ask you to bring us up to date on what is the Army Corps doing now? What is it working on now?
Well, the Corps of Engineers has looked at this as a multi-pronged approach. One is to try to stabilize the existing situation in the short term. Secondly, by looking at what studies or evaluations were underway prior to Sandy and looking to retool those with based on the information and knowledge gained actually during Sandy. And then lastly, looking at the long-term consequences on a regional scale as to, again, much like your intro mentioned, to see what would be the suite of options that would be available to us across the region, including, of course, relocations, elevating houses, et cetera. So right now, in the short term, we are basically repairing our existing portfolio of projects that were damaged as a result of Hurricane Sandy. That is, those jobs that were previously constructed and served as that sacrificial, fill for the absorbing the storm energy associated with Sandy. So we're working on that right now, and we're also going about in a really expeditious manner in terms of trying to make sure that all of our navigation channels that received increased sedimentation are also addressed as part of Sandy. And at the same time, we're looking at the long term.
In the short term, you're refilling the beaches with sand and elevating homes. Let's talk about the houses. How does the elevation or the putting them up on stilts work?
Well, in many of the locations here, we have homes. We have Barrier Island system, and then, of course, we have an estuary and a back bay environment. Typically on Long Island, in one stretch, 83 miles from Fire Island to Montauk Point, we had been working on a plan for probably over a decade to elevate about 4,500 homes that are located within the 10-year floodplain. To put that into context for you, there are approximately 27,000 homes that are located in the 100-year floodplain, and that is with our sea level rise and our numbers as we see them now. If you were to extrapolate this, let's say 50 years, 100 years into the future, that number could quadruple. So obviously you see, as time moves on here, we have a very severe problem that we have to address. Over.
Yeah. And who pays for elevating all those houses?
Well, in some cases, it's been a combination of different authorities. In some cases, using community block grant money through Housing and Urban Development, the states have undertaken some of this work. There has been some work undertaken in the past prior to, with FEMA funding. Individual homeowners have chosen to do it, some of them themselves. And then, of course, lastly, the Corps of Engineers is looking at that elevation of that 4,500 homes, and that would be borne by the federal government also.
So mostly we're talking about taxpayer money, local,
that is correct.
Federal. Rob Young, do you think elevating houses and structures is the way to go here?
Well, if the structures are going to remain in place, you'd certainly rather have them elevated than not. The problem with relying on elevating structures as your primary adaptation measure following a storm like Sandy is that it doesn't remove the property from the hazard area. It just lifts the property up above the hazard area. So, for example, if you're on the oceanfront or an estuarine shoreline, and we raise your home, you may be raised above the flood, but that doesn't stop the coastal erosion, and it doesn't stop long-term sea level rise. So if elevating properties is your primary response, then that means that we still have to commit ourselves to holding the shoreline in place in front of those properties for the foreseeable future. So, you know, to me, simply relying primarily on elevating structures, which is what we've been doing post-Sandy, is problematic in the long run.
And so your solution would be what?
Well, we need to begin a strategy where some of these oceanfront resort communities in particular, where those properties that are the most vulnerable in areas where there is repeat damage and identifiable risk from a scientific perspective, and scientists and hazard specialists know where these places are, local emergency managers know where these places are, we need to begin a managed retreat from those areas. And when I say managed retreat, I don't mean we go in there and we rip the houses down. That's not how we do things in the United States. And I'm not suggesting that we abandon the shore. What it means is that in these areas that have experienced repeat damage, where there's particularly high vulnerability, we should be pulling public funds. And if those individuals continue to choose to invest in those areas, they should be doing it on their own dime.
Phil Orton, you work with ocean modeling, and that means making a computer model out of the oceans and out of storm systems. Do you have Sandy as a computer model now?
Yes, we do, and we've been very eager to get a good sample of Sandy, a good model of Sandy from the weather to the storm surge side. So we put a lot of effort into that. We've got many storms that we can test. We can sort of throw at the coastline and run experiments on.
And you can see how the coastline would react and the consequences of the storm?
Well, for just studying the flooding, that's much simpler, the flooding and the waves, mm-hmm. so the storm tide and the waves. Studying how the erosion occurs is much more complex, and we aren't doing that at Stevens Institute.
I heard one meteorologist say that back in, was it 1992, there was that famous perfect storm that they made the novel and the movie out of. And the reason no one really talked about it until the novel and the movie came out is that it never really hit shore. It was sort of out in the ocean. Is that correct?
Yeah. And one correction. At Stevens Institute, with our group, we're not modeling erosion of the coast, but of course we have several researchers studying the erosion of the coast with other techniques. And on the perfect storm, your question there, the perfect storm is a very good example of something similar to Sandy, where it was a hurricane that came up the North Atlantic and it made a left turn in 1991, I think. Mm-hmm. And we've got a model of that storm too, actually, and it hovered south of Cape Cod and it never made landfall anywhere, but it was the highest ever storm surge at Boston.
Joe, you were working during that perfect storm, were you not?
I certainly was, and much of the plans that we're working on now came about as a result of some of the responses to that storm. I also want to back up just one moment and just address one issue that came up here about this notion of resort communities. If you really look at these areas that were particularly hard hit in Long Island and New York City, Rockaway, Coney Island, Long Beach, I would suggest to you that they're probably anything but resort communities. In fact, they're regular blue-collar working people who go to work every day. And if you think about it from the notion of a patient who goes to the hospital who's bleeding profusely, you don't really sit down with that patient and discuss their long-term prognosis. You first try to stop the bleeding while you have this more meaningful conversation about their long-term prognosis. And so our approach has been to that. And even as recently as this morning, the president released his executive order on looking at the effects and trying to prepare communities for the changes in climate change and sea level rise. So we take this notion very, very seriously. And I would like to tell you it started with 92, but it did not. If you look in the Long Island, New York City area, we could go back to 38, we could go back to 1960, 1962, 1992. It seems like every 30 years we have this so-called storm of the century, each one having a catastrophic effect on our landscape. Now, difference here on this one is Sandy actually has gotten people to actually start sitting down and talking about the effects of sea level rise and climate change. I've been doing this for 30 years, and this is the first time that I've gotten this kind of, what I would like to say, interactive dialogue going on with all levels of government and all levels of home, on what the long-term solution set might look like.
And do they want to? Is it possible to discuss something that might take 50 years to plan for?
You have all of this is not about engineering and science, in my opinion. It is about societal and political will. It is about the ability to change behaviors and behavior patterns. And so, no, they don't want to talk about that. What they want to really talk about is what's going to happen for me today. I'm out of my house. Thousands of people are still homeless. What are we doing to get people back in those communities? Now, I would agree with you. We do have to look at this long term, and you have to look at it down, into 50 years and 100 years down into the future, because some of these locations might be untenable, that far out into the future, some of these barrier islands, et cetera. So you have to stop the bleeding while at the same time you're trying to talk to them about what the long-term consequences of some of these actions are that are currently in place.
Rob Young, do you think it's possible to do that?
Well, which is exactly why we need a plan in place when storms hit. I mean, the problem with our response to Hurricane Sandy is that we had no plan for what we were going to do following a storm like this. We learned almost no lessons from Katrina. So, you're absolutely right that it's very difficult to go into these communities in the middle of an emergency and develop a managed retreat plan on the fly. And so the easiest thing to do when you have no plan is to basically do what we were doing before. And,
all right.
I think part of the problem is that many of the projects that the Corps designs for coastal protection, beach nourishment projects, they actually have sort of a 50-year planning horizon. And I think that gives much of the public the impression that it's going to be possible to hold all these shorelines in place for 50 years. And, I simply think that that's impractical. And I'm not saying that there aren't
some places that we should... We'll talk more about it. I got to go to a break. Talking with Robert Young, Joseph Vitri, and Phil Orton. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. We're talking with Robert Young, Joseph Vitri, and Philip Orton about lessons learned from Hurricane, then Superstorm Sandy. Our number 1-800-989-8255. And when I rudely interrupted Rob Young, he was telling us about whether it's possible. You were sort of critical of the Army Corps of Engineers there.
Why? Well, the Corps got
it sounded to me, and I will ask our guest Joe about this. It sounds like they are trying to figure out long term solutions, but they have the politics involved also.
Well, the Corps has got a tough job, I mean, they have demands placed on them from all different quarters, and they are typically asked for a level of protection that, I think is impossible to guarantee. And, to finish the thought that I was in the middle of, if you don't mind, saying is that there probably are some places where beach nourishment makes sense, but the fact of the matter is we can't do it everywhere. And right now, we don't have a good national plan that allows us to look at the entire East Coast, the entire Gulf Coast, and from a national perspective, do a very good job bringing in the best science and the best engineering and the best economics to decide where we're going to spend that money. Right now, our spending is purely reactive. We have a big storm, and the Corps has given approximately $4 billion that they need to spend in the North Atlantic Division on coastal protection projects. Is that the best place to spend it? Maybe. But it sure would be nice if we had, a well-organized scientific national plan to prioritize that spending.
Mm-hmm. Phil, what happens when you add barrier islands and you restore the wetlands and you put them into your storm model? Because that's what some people are saying. We've got to get those barrier islands, not just make sand dunes. We've got to create real living islands there and restore the wetlands, because they will help sop up some of the damage that occurred. So what happens when you put that in your model?
Well, barrier islands are probably the best protection you can have for a Back Bay region, if you know, although it depends on how wide and deep the inlets are into the Back Bays. But barrier islands are a very good protection, and they're already there in most places. The wetlands that are often in the embayments have been degrading a lot, especially in urban areas, due largely to nitrogen inputs from sewage treatment. And those wetlands, as they when they're there and they're strong, they can reduce flooding. If there's sort of a rule of thumb, which is very approximate, but it does give some sense of how much wetland area you need, and that is that it takes a few miles of wetland to reduce a flood height by about a foot. So there is a little bit of a misnomer for urban areas that you can have 100 feet of wetland, and that might help protect an urban waterfront. You really need these big coastal areas.
Big coastal areas. You ran an experiment which you tried a 20-foot high reef outside of New York Harbor in your model, did you not? What happened there?
Oh, well, we ran, a lot of this is experimentation with the designers and myself putting out ideas, the landscape designers, and then testing them out in the model. And so one idea was to have a large reef offshore of the mouth of Raritan Bay, sort of where the entrance channel to New York Harbor comes in, Ambrose Channel. And it actually didn't work. It didn't reduce. The idea was that it would reduce wave breaking into the harbor, which can raise sea levels a small amount inside the harbor, but it actually didn't help for the one storm we studied with that experiment, which was Hurricane Donna from 1960. We may get a different result for a Category 3 hurricane test that we're planning on doing, or for Sandy, but so far that was one of the non-successes.
Mm-hmm. And another idea you explored is shallowing the shipping channels, for example, in Jamaica Bay, right there by where JFK Airport is. What could that do?
Yeah, so, shipping channels into our major ports like Newark and Elizabeth are very important to our region's economies. But there's certain shipping channels now that are used much less frequently, like Rockaway Inlet and the shipping channels along the northern and southern parts of Jamaica Bay, which are where the populations are around Jamaica Bay. And right now they basically deliver the storm surge water very quickly without any attenuation around the shallow areas and the wetland areas in the center of the bay. They just deliver it straight to the neighborhood. So one thing that we realized early on was, and we saw with experimentation, was that the wetlands don't reduce the flooding on their own very much. They can reduce waves, and that helps. But if you just have a shallowing of these deep channels and it's slow, then it can slow the water reaching those neighborhoods and force it more into the wetlands instead of going around them. And you can reduce the flooding for a storm like Sandy by several feet or even eliminate flooding altogether inside the bay after the water travels over 10 kilometers of shallower water.
Mm-hmm. Joe Vitri, speaking for the Corps, what do you say are the components of a good coastal defense?
Well, I think there's two things. One, just backing up a second on this lack of a comprehensive strategy, one of the things that came about as a result of the Sandy Supplemental Bill is the fact that the Corps of Engineers was given $20 million to develop a regional and comprehensive evaluation of the long-term risk and vulnerability along the entire North Atlantic shoreline, roughly about 31,000 miles. And I just want to say for the record that, some of the things we are looking at is strategic retreat in addition to all of the suite of non-structural and structural solution sets. But in terms of what the Corps looks at in terms of what we would see adequate defenses, we like to think of it as tiered levels of defense, much like in old medieval times you had the castle wall. But before you got to that castle wall, you had a moat, you maybe had a killing field, you had something else. And so for us, I think this has been borne out time and time again, certainly in our performance evaluation of the projects immediately in the aftermath of Sandy, we've seen where you had a very healthy beach dune system, you tended to have far, far less damages than where you did not. So clearly for us, it would be a healthy barrier island system, including, a decent berm and a dune system, and then a very healthy estuary. And, these ecological features in the estuaries, whether it be marsh, salt marsh, or islands, et cetera, are also suffering the same threats that our population centers are as well. They are also taking the hit associated with, in addition to the nitrogen loading, but also basically changes in sea level rise have a potential to affect them dramatically, as well as basically settlement of these wetlands. So we're losing a large amount of wetlands, and this is going on around the country. You definitely see it in Jamaica Bay, Great South Bay, Mauritius Bay in our area. So for us, we like to look at it as basically a combination of gray and green infrastructure, and so with tiered levels of defense. And I think that is basically going to be right now, and it certainly started in coastal Mississippi, and it's carrying its way forward here into the New York region, as what you're going to see coming out of a lot of these activities that are being undertaken both by the Corps as well as others. The mayor's plan, just recently released, also relies heavily on these tiered levels of defense.
Rob Rung, what's wrong with these sort of soft infrastructure ideas instead of, sounds like a reasonable plan.
Well, building beaches through beachfill projects is certainly, in my opinion, a better way to protect coastal infrastructure than building massive seawalls is. If you build those seawalls, you're going to have to pump a beach up in front of them anyway. But I think we should understand, and we need to remember, that these beaches used to be ecosystems. And there are beaches in New Jersey that don't have a natural grain of sand on them. I mean, they're completely artificial constructs now designed to protect property. And if you're building beachfield projects as storm protection projects rather than ecosystem restoration projects, then you have a totally different set of criteria in mind. And if you look at some of the quote-unquote natural dunes that are being built in some of the post-Sandy projects, these are giant trapezoids. They don't look like natural dune fields anymore. We're not building ecosystems on our beaches. We're replacing them with storm protection projects. And in some places where we've been doing this for a long time, that's probably an appropriate response. But it's not a model that we'd like to export to the entire United States of America. It's hard to find beaches in some states nowadays that have never had fill dumped on them. And I don't think we have any idea what the cumulative impacts of doing all of these projects will be on the nearshore benthic environment. The Corps is planning on moving 20 to 30 million cubic yards of sand in New Jersey and New York post-Sandy over the next couple of years. And, that's equivalent to removing, making holes the size of 10 large football stadiums to borrow that sand, and then you spread it along the beach and bury the nearshore surf zone with that material. And some places it might be appropriate, but I think that we don't have any real perspective on what the long-term cumulative environmental impacts are of doing these kinds of projects, and we're only going to have to do them more frequently in the future.
Joe Vitri of the Corps, is that the kind of thing that you're going to be doing, or are you going to? I thought I heard you say it requires a lot more.
There were some factual inaccuracies in that statement, which these projects are heavily monitored. There, it is true there has been a lot of sand placement along these shorelines going back probably since the 1930s and even maybe before. There is a large body of evidence and a large body of historical evidence that supports that in a lot of these locations there is no environmental impact to doing this type of practice. Now, is this the solution set for the long term and well into the future? I would agree, with Professor Young. I think that we have to look at other solution sets, and it really is a function of both, one, of financial ability to do this. If you look at the different sea level rise scenarios, if it's been about 12 inches in 100 years, midpoint, let's say we're talking probably about 2 feet, but we could go up as high as 6 feet in 100 years. And so when you get into those upper reaches of that curve and those kind of numbers, all bets are off. It really is a question of what is the economic viability of this. If you're talking about it in terms of renourishment sequence, even at the highest maximum level of 6 feet in 100 years, these beaches are maintained roughly every 4 years. If you do the math real quickly, you'll see you're dealing with only about a 3-inch change in sea level rise in any one nourishment period. The good part about beach renourishment is if you stop it, things go back to the way they were fairly quickly. And I would agree 100%. I'm very much, and we are very much, do not recommend walls or any kind of vertically aligned structures along an open ocean coastline. We tend to look for these more softer solutions, which is beach fill. And until such time as that the economics don't work or we see some sort of environmental consequence, right now that remains in the tool bag available for use. It doesn't mean it's the only thing. It doesn't mean it should be used everywhere, but it should certainly be in and remain in the tool bag.
Phil Orton, you said you've said that one of the things in your tool bag that you've explored would be landscape architecture is in the form of oyster texture. What is oyster texture about?
Oyster texture is the concept of growing oyster reefs as wave-breaking coastal protection in harbor areas in particular. And, I mean, it's a good thing to steer toward here. We've only been talking about the open shore mainly and back bays so far. But when we think about New York Harbor, we've just got such large populations that the thought of retreat is even more difficult to think about. And so we're looking at New York Harbor and Staten Island shores, and we're looking at how these reefs could, on one hand, be used to reduce the physical threat and improve physical resiliency of the shoreline by reducing the wave heights that could overtop the coastal barriers or dunes or whatever is there, but also having community interaction, schools involved. And this is already actually occurring in New York Harbor with Governor's Island Harbor School and scape landscape design. So having more community involvement, education, people actually involved in building these protections and in seeding these oyster reefs, and then
how big would an oyster reef be?
Let me finish that one thought. And so then you can also have social resilience also by having people actually mm-hmm. interact with the hazard, the tides, the water, and know more about it, mm-hmm. and not be surprised as they were with Sandy, that you know the peak flooding came at high tide. And that it got over the landscape, edge and came into their neighborhoods. Right. They'll have more of an understanding of the hazard. So you have sociological resilience on top of physical resilience.
Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. So I'm Ira Flatow talking with Rob Young, Phil Orton, and Joe Vitri. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, Phil. Go ahead, finish up that thought on the oysters because it's fascinating.
Yeah, the heights of the reefs, it depends on where you are, but the idea is that they fill most of the water. The oysters can grow up to near the sea surface, and so they may dry during low tide and be wet during high tide. And then when there's a storm, then the waves in the harbor, which, you don't get huge waves in New York Harbor in particular, but you could imagine Barnegat Bay also is another site we were looking at, or Raritan Bay in front of Staten Island. And you can get pretty large waves, and so these could break those large waves before they reach the waterfront.
Mm-hmm. And this could be undertaken locally by the local population, or would they need assistance?
Yeah, it's something that's already occurring with a fair amount of success. The history of New York Harbor is that it was one of maybe the world's leading oyster capital for harvesting oysters 150 years ago to 100 years ago. And then, of course, pollution wiped it out. So there's a lot of groups right now, sort of a frenzy about oysters, and oysters on, like I said, they can reduce, so it's being successful already to regrow them in the harbor. One thing I'd say is they can reduce wave heights, but they're not very good for reducing the flood height, the total flood height. So they can prevent the waves from overtopping a waterfront, but they're not as good, even if you put them throughout the harbor, it's not clear from the modeling so far that they reduce flooding very much as a mean water level during a storm surge.
1-800-989-8255. How accurate, Phil, is our knowledge of what the sea level rise is going to be if you're going to plan for it? How do we know what it's going to be like in 10 or 50 years?
Well, the New York City Panel on Climate Change just put out a new assessment of sea level rise locally in our area, and we have a little bit of land subsidence, so it's a little bit different than the global sea level rise value. And also there's some ocean circulation changes that look like they're causing sea level rise to be worse across our region. So the estimate for the 2050s, I think the mean, the low end estimate, it's quite a big uncertainty. I think the mean estimate's about a foot and a half of sea level rise by the decade of the 2050s. But the low end is more like 9 inches, and the upper end's more like 3 feet. So it's a very large uncertainty still, unfortunately.
If I looked at those charts correctly, it looked like Florida was really in the bullseye of that sea rise.
Florida's in a lot of danger. If you compare New York City sea level rise problem to Florida, to Miami sea level rise problem, Miami, if you get a sea level rise of maybe 6 feet, or one way to put it is for every foot, and this is based on the Surging Seas tool online from Climate Central, you can dial up different sea level rise levels. And in Florida, with every foot of sea level rise beyond maybe 2 feet, they start losing the space to high tides that 5 or 10% with every extra foot of their population lives on around Miami. So you think of 6 feet of sea level rise, they lose a massive amount of their populated area. And fortunately, New York City has a lot of high ground, and we only lose about 1% of the populated land area, the area that mm-hmm. population lives on, only about 1% of the people lose their land area for every foot of sea level rise. So it's a little bit better for New York City that we do have some high ground.
We're going to have to leave it there. This is certainly just the start of a conversation about the new normal and how to deal with the flooding coastlines. I want to thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Joe Vitri is Director of National Planning, Center for Coastal and Storm Damage for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in New York. Robert Young, Professor of Coastal Geology at the Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Phil Orton, Research Scientist in Physical Oceanography at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.